the Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Yeah, tēnā koutou katoa. I'm Selwyn Manning and welcome to A View From Afar. And today we are joined as always by political scientist Paul Buchanan and we will analyse how the United States President Joe Biden has confirmed that US troops will be withdrawn from Afghanistan before the 20th anniversary, and that is on September 11th, 2021. But with Afghanistan being far from stable and with large sectors of Afghanistan once again in Taliban control, will this historically war-torn country of great significant strategic importance descend into civil war? It's one of the primary questions we're going to analyse today. And what are the competing interests vying for a piece of Afghanistan? There appears, and this is analysis by Paul Buchanan, we'll discuss this, there appears two significant blocks. There's the China-India-Pakistan axis, and there's the Iran-Russia axis. What are the motivations here? What are the risks and opportunities that await the people of Afghanistan, but also the people and those nations as they look to see what is an advantage of engagement in the post-US pullout period? And what about all of those nations that took part in the US-led occupation forces in Afghanistan? Do they all simply walk away from their geopolitical investment to forget that chapter in their history, forget the casualties, forget the deaths, forget the alleged war crimes and economic investments? And what of the Taliban in 2021? Is this new generation of Taliban leadership aware of the mistakes made by their most recent forefathers? Okay, so let's cross to Paul Buchanan now, who's waiting online. We'll discuss all of this and more. Good afternoon, Paul.
Tēnā koe, Selwyn. How are you?
Yeah, tēnā koe. Very good, thank you. Ka pai, Paul. Paul, so let's start with some of the basic kind of premises that are underlying the questions that people are putting with respect to the unknowns in Afghanistan. What would you expect over the next few months as the US ratchets up its withdrawal from Afghanistan? And we just note it has been pulling out troops significantly since May, hasn't it?
It certainly has. And in fact, the pace of withdrawal has accelerated to the point that reports that the last remaining combat troops could be out within a week or two. Wow. And what will be left are some intelligence liaison field officers and various logistics personnel. So the United States footprint is about to disappear, which means that the ISAF footprint, that is the coalition that came together under UN Security Council Council mandate to defeat the Taliban and then later on defeat al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, they too are leaving. In fact, my understanding is that both the Danes and the Germans took all their beer with them rather than leave it behind at Bagram. So what you're going to have, and of course there was supposedly a negotiated settlement that was signed in Doha about 6 or 7 months ago. Now it's clear it wasn't worth the paper it was written on because it guaranteed exchanges of prisoners. It guaranteed that the Taliban would behave in a certain way once the Americans left. None of that is happening. Nothing is being honored either way. I mean, they're pointing fingers at each other. And the Taliban have resumed an offensive in what is essentially the power vacuum being left by the withdrawal of Western forces. And everything indicates that they are going to win. They control one third of the country right now. The Afghan government, the government supposedly of national unity, is intensely unpopular. It's divided amongst itself. So there are rival factions within that government. And the Taliban are united in one thing only, and that is to regain power.
So are we looking at the prospect of conflict, or are we looking at a transition that is less violent with this new generation of Taliban?
Well, think of it as a very nasty version of carrot and stick. There will be fighting. There will be fighting up through and beyond the Taliban conquest of power. The minority view is that maybe the Ghani government can negotiate a deal with the Taliban to promote a peaceful transition and a power-sharing arrangement. That's what the West certainly hopes. But I think they shouldn't get their hopes up too high, because the Taliban have proven time and time again that, to use a trite phrase, they are resilient. You know, they take a beating and they come back for more. And they've developed certain skills. You mentioned it in the intro. This is not the Taliban of 2001. They have lost thousands of fighters. They have lost hundreds of leaders. And yet they're still standing. They're still fighting. In fact, they control more territory now than any time since 9/11. And so they're younger. They're more savvy. They know a lot more about what the people of Afghanistan want.
Well, let's pick that up. Sorry, to Paul, to interrupt. There's a little bit of a lag there sometimes too, so apologize for that overlap. But if we look at what the people of Afghanistan want, what they expect, is there common ground there with the Taliban? For example, what would you expect of this generation of Taliban and their policies? How would that impact on Afghani women? And the opportunities of which, well, now we have a generation away from what was obviously draconian, very strict and brutal control that the Taliban had prior to 9/11, all those years, 20 years ago.
Well, without being an expert on Afghan politics or the Taliban per se, I will say this. The ISAF intervention, which again has gone on 20 years, has developed infrastructure in Afghanistan that it never had before. Now, yes, it was for war fighting purposes and whatnot, but now it's going to devolve to civilian usage, highways, roadworks of all sorts, sanitation networks, things that the Afghans had never really experienced in large measure. And the Taliban do not have the expertise to handle a lot of these infrastructural modernities. We have to remember that Afghanistan is a female-heavy population because the fighting has taken a toll on men on all sides. Men are a relatively scarce commodity. And I say that because the Taliban may realize that if they want engineers, if they want even bureaucrats to shuffle paper in national ministries, they're going to have to look to women to do so. So this version of the Taliban, let's call them Taliban 2.0, may not be as averse to female education and those sort of things that the West is very much focused on, because it's out of necessity that they need to lighten up a little bit on patriarchal control of women's lives.
So now, on that, sorry, Paul, once again. So we have got the circumstance of which you're making those comments and applying that analysis to. Do we see any evidence within the Taliban that they may actually have changed?
Well, certainly negotiating strategies indicate that there is, a newer generation of leaders who are more sophisticated, better educated, as it turns out, mostly educated in Pakistan, who know how to negotiate with sophisticated diplomats, such as those of the United States and the ISAF coalition, as well as the United Arab Emirates. You know, they were the mediators. And so this version of the Taliban, I'll give you a for instance, they're Sunni. They originated in Kandahar. That's the province from which they came. They are not very much welcome in places like Bamiyan, where the NZDF had the provincial reconstruction team, New Zealand's presence, just for our foreign interlocutors. New Zealand was in Bamiyan for over 10 years. doing some combat duties, but mostly trying to do civilian reconstruction and nation-building projects. Again, those infrastructure projects. Those people, the Hazaris, are Shia. And we'll talk about Iran in a second in the context of protecting Shia interests. Well, one could see a power-sharing arrangement where the Taliban will assume control of Sunni-dominant areas in Afghanistan, but allow a more secular or a more Shia-dominated faction to control those areas of Afghanistan that have Shia majorities. I mean, it's possible.
I get that. What I'm picking up too from international coverage, most significantly with Al Jazeera, is that where courts, you know, if we look at the courts and justice system of which has been applied in Afghanistan over the last number of years, where things have fallen down and where Taliban have an influence, that they're set up Sharia courts, for example, and that those kind of examples of Taliban rule are well in advance in various provinces, it would appear from the reportage. So if we are starting to look at whether or not there was power sharing kind of things, there are two things to come that come to mind. Taliban's interests way back were to establish a fairly extreme version, and they did establish a very extreme version of governance over Afghanistan when they had control. So that would be something to test out, wouldn't it? And whether or not this new generation of Taliban actually see that as something that has been problematic for themselves as opposed to an advantage. The other thing is where, I suppose it's a broader regional kind of observation, not specific to Afghanistan or Pakistan, but if you looked across at Iraq, the sharing of power between Shia and Sunni, well, it didn't go down too well, did it?
No.
To say the least. But then again, you know, a very wise moment with a New Zealand correspondent and expert in Afghanistan reportage once said to me, the problem lies in the occupation forces, that they're a part of the problem, not the solution. So it just, you can see the complexities in this traditionally and historically war-torn country as to what is the best way forward. If you look at from the point of view of all of those countries, the Nordic countries, the Scandinavian social democratic countries, countries like Australia and New Zealand and many others, or Britain, United States-led efforts in stabilising and occupying Afghanistan, that question that we put in the introduction, Paul, do they simply, all of these countries, this whole coalition of countries with self-interest up there, do they forget, walk away from that period in their history because it has been too hard to fix? Do they forget the casualties, the deaths of which they have committed, you know, at their own kind of efforts, but also their own deaths, alleged war crimes, the, you know, as I understand it, trillions of US dollars has gone into this effort. Can it all be gone within a matter of months?
Well, the short answer is yes. Now, you've broadened it out a little bit, so let me tease this out. The with regards to ISAF and the foreign powers that were part of the occupation force, they're going to try to shift their influence to civilian reconstruction, supporting the civilian bureaucracy. Not imposing a secular state, that won't happen, but trying to not even impose, try to install some degree of modernity to Afghan civil society. And so that'll be their way. I mean, the joke, and it's a bad joke, is that it stinks to be the last guy shot in Afghanistan. I mean, the morbid humor of the military units is, won't it be my luck? I'll be getting on the last plane out, and some sniper will decide he's going to take one more go before we leave. And that's, you know, I mean, it's not called the graveyard of empires for nothing. I mean, there are lessons that the militaries of these advanced, you know, democratic countries in large measure need to understand when you're fighting an irregular force on its home turf, and they're a fractious lot at best. Now, the issue here, though, you made a very good point about the Taliban setting up their own system of courts and whatnot, but let's do this. let's think about what the Taliban gained. Taliban 1.0, the militant version that was ousted after 9/11. Let's see. They were very militant, very extreme. They committed all sorts of atrocities. And they harbored Al-Qaeda, the leadership of Al-Qaeda, from which the 9/11 attacks were planned. What did that earn them? It earned them an occupation and a hard pounding by the militaries of a number of countries, particularly the United States. I mean, it didn't go well for them, even though they've now rebounded and a new generation is standing. Well, I think that the Taliban 2.0 understand that the bottom line is they cannot allow Al-Qaeda or ISIS, any Sunni extremist group, to find safe haven, plan, stage any foreign attack from Afghan soil, because we'll just have a repeat of the previous scenario. And here's, this is a bit of a tangent, but let's since we're going to talk about some of the other powers who are now eyeing Afghanistan. I was part of, when I worked in the Pentagon, I was the regional guy for Latin America. So I would talk with the other regional people. This is 93, 94, and the Black Hawk Down incident occurred in Mogadishu at the time. And of course, we know that didn't go well for the American peacekeeping forces that were trying to take the peace there. They were trying to capture this Somali commander by the name of Adid. Anyway, that's the brief history. A discussion group exists between the regional guys from back in the day, and someone threw out the line, what would have happened if instead of American troops and other blue helmets, there were Russian troops in Mogadishu on that day? And the answer from the more experienced people, the people that, you know, in uniform that I worked with, were that hundreds of thousands of Somalis would have died. You know, their point was the Russians will come in. They won't try, they won't fight according to the laws of war. They will kill until people stop shooting at them. And they would have captured Adid. I mean, ruthless. And some of that's been borne out by Russian behavior in Syria. Well, in Afghanistan, there are interests, including the Russians, who want to pick up the pieces when the United States leaves. Remember, the United States is leaving bases, it's leaving commissaries, it's leaving, you know, buildings, it's leaving infrastructure for the taking. And so, and again, the Taliban don't have the intellectual wherewithal to operate all these things that the Americans can't destroy before they leave. And so some of the powers that are eyeing Afghanistan, particularly China, but not exclusively. The Russians are in, the Indians are in, and we'll talk about that in a second, and of course the Pakistanis are in. Let's just say that involvement by these external forces may not follow the path of the Western ISAF forces when dealing with the Taliban. They may be more brutal, they may mass many more numbers than the ISAF coalition did. See, the ISAF coalition, because it was a coalition of mostly democracies, they had to contend with domestic opposition, you know, pacifists, you know, people didn't want to see them there. If the Russians or the Chinese get involved, and the Russians have been burnt once, so you can be assured that should they get involved again, the lessons learned from that ill-fated campaign of the late 70s will not be repeated. They will come in, and then the Taliban are going to have some reckoning. So what I would say is simply that the version 1.0 should not occur again, because the Taliban leadership understands they brought it on themselves, even though they've prevailed over the long term. And they can get a lot more by cooperating with new foreign interests. And this is where there's opportunity here for these new power players, and not being just sort of knee-jerk xenophobic towards all foreigners if the foreigners are not military occupiers. And that's where the opportunity comes for particularly five countries. China has an economic interest in Afghanistan. It already is in Afghanistan in the minerals exploitation business on a small scale, again, using American constructed stuff to pursue their own interests now. The their allies, Pakistan, have always had an interest in seeing that Afghanistan remain weak as a buffer on their border. And so they will be interested in seeing that the Taliban don't get too strong, don't influence the Taliban in Pakistan. They'll try to find a modus vivendi. And against those two interests, India has decided to make a play, if nothing else, to raise the costs to both China and Pakistan for maintaining their presence in Afghanistan, because the Indians can offer inducements to the Taliban that the other two cannot. And then on the other side, we have the Russians and the Iranians. And for those two countries, the issue is really quite simple. It's all about geopolitical buffering. The Russians want a deeper buffer on their south central borders, so the Stans. They want to wrap up the Stans as a buffer zone between them and Mother Russia proper. And they've got Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, are all Uzbekistan as well, are all pro-Moscow leaning. They need Afghanistan to tilt in their direction. And then the Iranians, of course, want a buffer on their eastern border. They share a very long border with Afghanistan, and they have an interest as the seat of Shia power in the world. They have an interest in protecting the rights of Shia in the Afghan Republic. So they'll be contending for power. The Russians and Iranians are already partners in many ventures. I don't think that they'll have any problem coordinating their strategies. The real interesting part will be how the Taliban react, this 2.0 version of the Taliban, to the various economic and perhaps military overtures of those various factions, because the Taliban can live for a while as a military power on surplus Western equipment. But at some point, they're going to have to start purchasing weapons. And there's plenty of suitors on that regard, but the exchange would be they have to open up their economy to investment from these foreign interests in exchange for allowing their arsenals to be replenished by those very same customers.
Mm. So the way you've described it, it's like the current government in Kabul. It sounds like it's going to be squeezed out one way or the other. The Taliban, obviously, as a force, is occupying much of the country, if not a majority of the country at the moment. You've got other external interests that are contrary to where the United States and the Western countries have been applying themselves over the last 20 years. It may be from the point of view of some sort of cooperative kind of approach that stability comes from that, but it seems unlikely when you've got clashing regional powers with different interests that are intersecting, doesn't it? And history shows us that transition is never, very seldom, we should say, a smooth operation. Paul, I'll just what we'll do at this juncture is I'll pull in some of the comments that have come in from the audience. We brought them up on screen just in a visual sense, but I'll read out a selection, a couple of those. Then we'll go to what, particularly how Al Jazeera has been reporting this. Then we'll come back and make sense of this whole thing and kind of see where the impact on the United States' interests there would be from the point of view of bringing its military back home from that region. Where do you see its... where is a redeployment and the shifting kind of thing of the United States' footprint most likely to be? But let's just bring this up. Now, first off, we've got a comment that has come through from YouTube from Craig Burns, and he says, New Zealand, for example, and we're broadcasting from New Zealand here, Craig Burns says, New Zealand needs to forget Afghanistan. Pakistan under Imran Khan is the only sensible option for New Zealand to back. We've got Gray O'Sullivan who comes through and says the Taliban are largely Pushtun. That is where the main base of operations are. They are not fully Afghani-wide grouping and never have been. Also, Gray has made a number of comments here. We'll just pick up a couple more here. The Taliban will not be able to control the country any more than the current Afghan government can. And also, Gray makes a comment. Then there is the role of the Islamic State supporters, and this is something you just touched on in brief, Paul. They are likely to seek to attack any weak Taliban regime. So it's a picture coming in from the comments of problems, obviously, and chaos is the expectation if we put it that way. Now, so let's go across to what Al Jazeera has been reporting over the last week, and it has been continuing to factor Afghanistan very highly in its reportage, and good on them for that.
Here, September 11th, and that could strengthen the Taliban even more. So who exactly are the Taliban? How is it that they have so much power? And why are people worried they'll take over Afghanistan again? To understand the Taliban, you need to know what happened in Afghanistan in the 1980s. Afghan guerrillas called the Mujahideen fought a Soviet occupation for 9 years. They even got money and weapons from the CIA. In 1989, the Soviets pulled out, and the next few years were pretty chaotic. By 1992, there was a full-blown civil war with tribal leaders fighting for power. 2 years later, a militia called the Taliban started getting attention. Many of its members had studied in conservative religious schools in Afghanistan and across the border in Pakistan, and some of them had also fought as Mujahideen. And they had their own plans for the country.
The people were so frustrated with this lawlessness, and the Taliban came marching along from Kandahar to city to city to city, saying, we're gonna make the cities safe for you again.
By 1996, the Taliban had seized the capital. They declared Afghanistan an Islamic emirate and started imposing their own strict interpretation of Islamic law.
They were like, you can't watch movies, you can't listen to music, women can't go to school, and other than doctors, they can't go to work. You have to wear a certain type of clothes, you have to have a certain kind of beard, you know, it just became more and more restrictive.
Then 9/11 happened. The US was after Al-Qaeda's leader Osama bin Laden, who was hiding out in Afghanistan with the Taliban's help. The Taliban said they wanted proof he was behind the attack, and when they refused to hand him over immediately, the Americans invaded.
The Taliban will pay a price.
Within a couple of months,
And we know the history from there, Paul, don't we? And I just wanted to salute Al Jazeera for its timeline analysis in that way, and I thought it packaged it very well. If we go on to this big question that we touched on earlier, Paul, but we have the opportunity now with time to perhaps thrash it out a bit more. What about all of those nations that took part in the US-led occupation forces in Afghanistan? Do they simply walk away from their geopolitical investment to forget that chapter in their history, forget the casualties, the deaths, the alleged war crimes, the economic investment? So let's look at that, Paul, in all its forms, and if you can take us through your view and your analysis in that area.
Let me start by saying that when I was watching that clip, two things struck me. The first is that most of the Taliban fighters that were depicted in those clips are now dead. Those fellows do not exist anymore. And they were riding around on old model Soviet tanks. Those tanks no longer exist. Let's just say that they're surplus to requirements in this day and age. So again, we're now dealing with a very different Taliban. And I wanted to say something to Gray, because he raises some good points. The Taliban are originated, they are Pashtun. They came from Kunar province mostly. But they want to be the central government. This is where I disagree with Gray. They may not be a majority, and particularly in Western, Northwestern Afghanistan, but their ambition is to be the state, to control the Afghan state in a multi-ethnic country. And they have the capability to do that, but not in the way they did in their original version. They will have to compromise more. Again, Afghan society has moved since 9/11. Again, the people, especially, there's an urban-rural dichotomy, a marked one. But in places like Kabul, people are relatively modern. They've seen the benefits of, you know, modern engineering and all that sort of thing. And so I think that the Taliban, if they want to achieve their goals, they will have to moderate their approach to ruling. And that is antithetical to any harboring of Islamic extremists. Remember, be it Al-Qaeda, or be it ISIS, or Daesh, as is more properly known, these are irregular groups that have shown that they govern with great difficulty, to put it politely. And so the interests of these groups are not entirely coincident with those of the Taliban, which is trying to establish itself as the sovereign of the Afghan Republic. And so I think that there's room there for them to use the learning curves of the last 20 years to try to not impose a particularly militant brand of Sunni Islam and Wahhabism, but instead to try to negotiate a more moderate understanding of, for example, the rule of Islamic courts.
But who would it negotiate with?
Well, you have, see, the one thing about the Afghans is they make the word decentralized seem too robust. They're very much divided, not only into sort of regional and local levels, but if you get into the mountainous hinterland, I mean, you're literally talking villages that are basically autonomous and self-governing, that resist the encroachment of strangers. And I'm not talking about Europeans, any strangers coming into their valleys. And that, and so they've normally been left alone. See, even during the Taliban rule, there were some places where they simply didn't go because there was nothing there that would make the costs of trying to subjugate these people worthwhile. And so we may see a return to that, but certainly the larger concentrations, urban concentrations in and around the country, including in Bamiyan, you're dealing with populations that are not Pashtun and are not Sunni. And I don't think forcibly exterminating them is going to be a solution set. So it is very possible that this version of the Taliban, in order to be able to govern, understanding that if it goes back to its militant ways, even Pakistan will turn its back on them. And here's a very important thing to keep in mind. The last thing the Saudis, the UAE, the Qataris, basically the Sunni Arab oligarchies, the last thing they need is another extremist Sunni group associated with the kingdoms in the Middle East returning to Afghanistan to run their training camps and conduct operations outside of Afghanistan, courtesy of the safe haven provided. None of the big Sunni powers want that to happen ever again. They'd rather things be more, you know, more of a subterfuge, you know, more quiet in terms of their subverting Shia interests and Western interests. And so I think the Taliban have a lot of incentive, a lot of carrot, towards leaning towards moderation. And again, all those economic incentives that I mentioned with these foreign powers trying to get in and exploit, because Afghanistan is mineral rich. I mean, absolutely mineral rich. If you allow militants to come in and they start, and you start imposing strict Sharia law, that's going to drive away investment. You know, and remember, the Chinese have issues with their Uyghurs, or I should probably better say The Uyghurs are being oppressed by the Chinese in their ethnic homelands because of their religion and their culture. Well, I doubt very much that the Chinese would take a big interest in Afghanistan if they didn't have guarantees that their investments would be protected from militant Islam and the preachings of radical clerics.
Yeah,
so there's
points
a moment
taken.
Of opportunity here.
Yeah, points taken. So let's look at this issue relating to those countries who have had interests in Afghanistan in the last 20 years by way of the coalition of occupying forces. So what do you see is the outcome of this decision that Joe Biden has confirmed? And I suppose it's fair to say that Donald Trump, his predecessor, was actually pushing for this to occur under his administration as well, but Biden has confirmed this and an aspirational goal to be out of there within the 20-year anniversary of 9/11. That symbolically suggests to myself that it's like he's going to try and package this as a job well done, a job concluded, and doesn't sound like it's anything but. So what do you see is the pressures on these governments and trying to come to terms with their involvement over the last 20 years?
Well, I think that, as former Prime Minister John Key said here a few years ago, that's the price for being in the club. So the Norwegians, the Danes, the Poles, the Italians, all these countries that put military forces into Afghanistan and suffered losses. That's the price of responding to the post 9/11 call to join the United States in the so-called war on terrorism.
But surely those countries and their populations would expect an enduring benefit from 20 years of blood, toil, and cost.
Maybe the benefit is the Taliban 2.0. I mean, maybe it's going to be no more than that. I mean, unfortunately, and you know me well, so you know that I'm not a pacifist, but people argued way back when, why are we getting involved here? The Afghans got to sort this out, and once you eliminate Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, you should declare victory and leave. And they didn't. They stayed and they got into nation building and that sort of thing. That was the mission creep. The slippery slope that led to 20 years of guerrilla warfare, because that was what was going on from the other side. I think this is the interesting thing. Now, Biden is fulfilling promise, which was simply to withdraw from Afghanistan. I don't think Trump had the intellectual capability to understand the full magnitude of that decision, but it was probably the appropriate one to do, given that the war, if it ever could have been won, was certainly lost a long time ago. What the United States wants now is intelligence. You see, under the umbrella of the occupation of Afghanistan, the United States has set up a number of remote, if you will, field intelligence gathering offices, mostly but not exclusively operated by the CIA. Where, among other things, they keep an eye on militants in the other stands. So Kyrgyzstan, all of these different stands have iridescent Islamicist movements in them, and the CIA has an interest in getting out in front of that. Of course, if you're in Afghanistan, you can watch the movements of the Taliban between Pakistan and Afghanistan. The U.S. has, in other words, a robust intelligence gathering a network presence in Afghanistan. And my understanding is that that's one of the thorny points of discussion with both the Ghani government and the Taliban leadership, because the United States would like to be able to continue to run those stations, maybe in a cooperative way with some of the regional powers. For example, that's an area where the U.S. and Russia could agree in terms of the security of Tajikistan, Uzbekistan. They might have find a modus vivendi. And that apparently is still under discussion. But other than that, and trying to keep Afghanistan with some degree of modernity so that it doesn't revert to the dark ages, the United States is pretty much done. And if the United States is done, then I doubt very much that there's European allies, particularly in the wake of Trump, are going to pick up the slack.
Yeah, that makes sense. And just to acknowledge a couple of things there, that the United States, it seems at this stage, is its intent is to leave 400 to 600 soldiers basically in Afghanistan after the complete withdrawal has occurred.
They're supposed to be trainers. So they're mostly Army Green Berets doing training for the Afghan National Army. If you look at any of the recent fights between the Afghan National Army and the Taliban, whatever training is occurring is not working. And they've lost their most celebrated combat commander, a colonel, in the Afghan Army Special Forces in an ambush that was staged and conducted with insider help within that commander's unit. So it's an uphill struggle for the secular Afghan government.
And one of the concluding kind of ideas, and it's stimulated from Craig Burns' comment here, is that Craig Burns is making the comment, Pakistan is the only real country to be able to negotiate with the Taliban. There may be something in that, and perhaps what would be interesting would be to watch the United States' interests with Pakistan to see whether or not Pakistan is one of those countries that the United States can influence in some way with respect to Afghanistan in the post-withdrawal period, Paul. Just your comment on that before we conclude the program.
Yeah, I was going to say, just as a final thing, that there is room to maneuver there because the CIA, the United States Intelligence, and the Pakistani ISI have, what might be a love-hate relationship. They are deeply intertwined in terms of their intelligence gathering efforts in South Central Asia. They disagree on many things. But for example, there is some indication that the raid on Osama bin Laden did not occur without the knowledge of the ISI, that they were given a heads up that this was gonna happen, to not interfere, and they did not. Which, was a loss of face for the Pakistanis because the Americans violated their sovereignty to get to him. But I say that anecdotally because there is room for cooperation between certainly the U.S. intelligence services and the Pakistanis against common foes. And the question is, can that be reconciled with these other power contenders jockeying for position? Because again, the prize is a stable, peaceful Afghanistan that can be economically exploited by foreign powers without a military occupation. And that's a hard nut to crack, but it's pretty clear that some are going to try it now that the U.S. is out of the picture.
Yeah, it's fascinating geopolitics, to say the least. And once again, Paul, thanks for your company today, and thanks for your contribution and taking us through the analysis of what is clearly one of the most complex situations that the world has basically been experiencing over the last 20 years or going beyond that too. To the public, thank you for your participation today in the program, and also for your company as well as we've gone through this. And we look forward to your company once again in 1 week's time from now on Thursday, New Zealand time around midday, which is Wednesday in the evening around 8 p.m. on Eastern Standard Time in the United States. So until that time, thank you again. Take care, and we look forward to seeing you again. Bye-bye.